Ms. Cohen, welcome back to Radio Times. Tomorrow night, the Committee to Protect Journalists is honoring four intrepid journalists at their 2011 International Press Freedom Awards. These four have taken great risks to tell important stories, and they've endured threats, harassment, assaults, censorship, and torture. One of the honorees joins us today on Radio Times. Umar Chima is an investigative reporter for The News, that's Pakistan's daily newspaper, where he covers corruption and politics, terrorism, and national security. A bit more than a year ago, he was kidnapped, beaten, humiliated, and told to keep quiet. Instead, Chima went public about what happened to him and has focused attention on anti-press violence in his country. And Umar Chima, nice to have you with us on Radio Times, and congratulations as well.
Thank you very much. It's being an honor.
Well, it's an honor to have you with us on the air. Let me also introduce Joel Simon, and he's the executive director of the Committee to Protect Journalists. And Joel, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be back with you.
And you are honoring Umar Chima from Pakistan, also a journalist from Bahrain, from Belarus, from Mexico. Was it hard to pick four honorees this year?
It's hard. It's always hard. We could have an award ceremony each month and still not honor all the courageous journalists who are out there doing this kind of work. So these are really the best of the best. It's an enormous challenge, but we're really thrilled that to have such a terrific group of courageous journalists with us.
And we're going to hear from Umar Chima about what happened to him, but just a quick, I guess, snapshot, if you would, of the journalists from Bahrain, from Belarus, and from Mexico. Help us understand who they are.
Well, each one of these journalists has really put their lives and liberty on the line to bring us the news from places where violence, repression are just part of the daily challenge they have to confront. In Bahrain, there's been ongoing protests in sort of an extension of the Arab Spring. There's a deep divisions between Shiite and Sunni communities there, and that's led to violent repression. And there's a newspaper, Al-Wasat, that has continued day in and day out to cover developments in that country. The editor who we're honoring, Mansour Al-Jamri, has been jailed as a result. The paper has faced systematic repression, but he's continuing to do his job. In Culiacan, Mexico, there's an amazing newspaper called Rio Dulce. And Culiacan is kind of the center of the drug trafficking in Mexico. And journalists in Mexico are routinely killed and sometimes brutally executed. There have been decapitations, horrific crimes against the press there. This newspaper, despite that violence, covers the drug trade, covers corruption day in and day out. At one point, somebody came into the newspaper, threw a grenade in the newsroom. Luckily, nobody was injured, but they understand what they're up against each day. And in Belarus, Europe's last dictatorship, Alexander Lukashenko, rules that country with an iron fist, does not tolerate any dissent, and there's a website called Charter 97, edited by a tremendously brave reporter named Natalia Radina. She was arrested, abused in prison, forced to leave her country. She's living in exile in Lithuania, but she's undeterred. She's continuing to publish her newspaper, her website, and to denounce and document the abuses committed by the Lukashenko government.
Well, Umar Chima, let me get you in on the conversation. And you're an investigative reporter for The News. How long have you been working at The News?
I've been with The News since 2007.
And what kinds of stories have you covered in these past couple of years?
Yeah, I have been working about the corruption stories in the government department, the corruption being committed by the political elite, the lack of accountability within the government by the different government, top government officials, and about the national security establishment.
And I do want to talk about what happened to you, but even leading up to September 2010 when you were kidnapped, had you been told to, you know, stop writing these stories?
You know, I have been receiving threats, but these are not threats as they are interpreted. They are not. You are not delivered some harsh messages. You are invited. You have a friendly counseling, but you have in mind that in case I am not going to honor it, it means that I am going to earn the ire of the top authorities, of the powerful people. So I have been receiving such messages for a long time. But every time I told them that, and every time whenever somebody called me, I wanted to make it sure that we hold the meeting. Just the purpose was in order to make them convinced that I don't have any personal grudge against anybody, against any institution. It's my duty to tell the truth to the people. If I'm writing something wrong, you have to point out. But if you don't have anything to contest, then let me do what I'm doing. And it's your job to improve yourself, to refine yourself, mm-hmm. to straighten out the problems.
I read about, actually, back in 2004, you actually hit by a car.
Yeah, it was December 2004. I was heading home, and I was going by foot when a car hit from my back. And not only it hit me once, it first hit me, and I fell down, and I started rolling.
Ooh.
And then the car, he applied the brake after first hit, and where I stopped rolling, it again advanced, and it passed over me from my left leg, from my ankle. So by the first hit, I had my fibula bone broken. With the second hit, my ankle was broken. So I had two fractures that kept me bedridden for the next six months. And in the meanwhile, when I was hospitalized, I was receiving calls from anonymous sources. They were asking me the sources of different stories. Who gave you the story? I said that whether there is something wrong with it. They said that this is not the question. That, the question is, who is the source? I said, has it been mentioned in the story? They said, no. So I said, it means that if it has not been mentioned, I'm not going to disclose my sources. So the warning was that we don't expect such stories from a serious journalist like you. So I said that if I am serious, the story is not serious, non-serious either. It is serious like me. But you know that it happens, and but we keep going.
Well, does anyone know who was driving that car, or who had ordered someone to drive that car and hit you?
Actually, no. There was no investigation carried out. We registered the complaint with the police. It was not taken seriously. The journalists made protests. Some opposition parties, they issued condemning statements, but the situation could not go beyond it. So this was what only happened. The government, they even didn't form any committee to investigate.
Let me ask you about then what happened. This was September 2010, and I don't want to tell the story for you, but you were kidnapped, and it sounds like kidnapped by some people who were wearing military fatigues. Where were you, and what happened?
Incidentally, in 2004, I was hit by the car on December 4 night. In 2010, I was hit. I was picked up on September 4. Four has not been good for me.
A good number for you.
Yeah,
no, I can understand.
Yeah,
what
yeah.
happened?
So it was early in the morning, and I was heading home after an unusual late night sitting with friends. It was 3 a.m. When my car was surrounded by two others, and two men came out. They were wearing actually police commando uniform. And they read a fabricated murder charge sheet. They said that you have run over a man, he has been crushed dead, and you have fled the scene. And you know that I was quite baffled what they are talking about. They're getting crazy what they are saying. But when I countered them that you are wrong, they said that, look, you have to join us to the police station. In case you are found innocent, you will be released. And I didn't have the luxury to resist, because being at 3 a.m., there was nobody around. In case I would resist, they would misbehave me. So I thought I wanted to be gentleman, to behave with them in a gentleman manner, so that in order to avoid any humiliation. So I said, okay, let me join you. I was seated in the vehicle, they were having a Land Cruiser Jeep. I was seated into it, and they blindfolded me. They, in fact, gagged me, muzzled me. So and they handcuffed me, and they took away my wallet, they took away my mobile phone, they took away my glasses. And then I realized that there is something serious. It is more than just a murder charge sheet. They are going to do something else with me. But I was just making a guessing game that who could they be if they are from policemen, because in fact I was doing a story about a police chief too. So I thought that he might have tried to teach me a lesson his way, but having their history, I thought that it would be very difficult. And if he has decided doing it, that won't be without trouble for him either. So the second idea in my mind that they could be from some intelligence agency, and it was quite horrific idea that because after and in this war and terror, there are many people who have gone missing. They have been picked up and they have been kept detained without any trial. Even their families don't know where they are. Even today, they don't know. So it was quite horrific that I may be another addition into it.
Well, and I'm sure those were some of the thoughts going through your head. But I have to say, having read about what happened to you, is you were, you know, you were beaten, you were whipped, you were stripped naked, you were humiliated by these people.
Yeah, I was taken to some unknown place. I didn't know. I still don't know where I was, but because I was continued to be blindfolded. They tore apart my shirt. Then I was my pant was taken off, and I was completely naked. I was forced to lie on the floor with my face down, and my I was continuously blindfolded and handcuffed. And they started beating at my back with a leather strip that is generally used for punishing the criminals. So they tortured me for almost half an hour, and then they removed the clothes used for blindfolding, and they had my head shaved and my eyebrows were shaved, and they also forced me make different poses to take pictures of my naked body. I remained in the captivity for 7 hours, and later I was dumped 100 miles outside the city.
Well, I'll tell you what, I want to absorb all that and also take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. The voice you just heard is Umar Chima, and he's an investigative reporter for The News. That's Pakistan's daily newspaper, and he's one of four journalists being honored by the Committee to Protect Journalists. In fact, they have their 2011 International Press Freedom Awards tomorrow night, and Umar Chima is talking about what happened to him, and also we're going to talk about the fact that he decided to speak out as opposed to stay silent about what happened to him and why that's important. Also with us is Joel Simon, and he's the executive director of the Committee to Protect Journalists. We're going to take a very short break, then we'll get back to our conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Garden State Wine Growers Association supports WHYY and presents their Holiday Wine Trail Weekend, November 25th, 26th, and 27th. There are 27 participating New Jersey wineries offering seasonal barrel tastings, live entertainment, and special holiday food pairings. Wine lovers can plan their adventure through New Jersey Wine Country. For location information online, newjerseywines.com.
Every music fan knows the feeling of putting on a new record and hearing pure disappointment come through the speakers. That's why we've made calling out these turkeys a Sound Opinions holiday tradition. I'm Greg Kot.
And I'm Jim DeRogatis. This week, it's our annual turkey shoot. From the Butterball to the Tofurkey, we run down this year's greatest musical disappointments.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
They are one of the top-selling R&B groups of all time. Their voices have melted the hearts of millions of fans. Now their sound is reaching a new audience.
We still have 9-year-olds coming to concerts singing End of the Road, and they would never even hear.
Boyz II Men on their new album, 20, next time on Tell Me More.
Let you go. It's
this afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
I belong to you.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. The Committee to Protect Journalists is honoring four courageous journalists tomorrow night for their determination to report on important stories and speak out in spite of threats. And Pakistani investigative reporter Umar Chima is one of those honorees, and we just heard the beginning part of his story. Also with us is Joel Simon, the executive director of the Committee to Protect Journalists. And lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Umar, I do want to go back to your story, but let me get Joel Simon back in on the conversation. And we're hearing in vivid detail what happened to him, the sort of horrifying thought of being essentially kidnapped, abducted, blindfolded, gagged, and then beaten and whipped, and as he said, dumped back on the street after 7 or 8 hours. Can you just add your thoughts, Joel, to what Umar was just telling us?
Well, I mean, my thoughts are what incredible courage he had after this happened to continue with his reporting. And I'm frankly inspired by Umar and the way that he talks about the responsibility that he has as a journalist to inform the public of Pakistan about what's happening. And he's also, frankly, informing the world, because it's very difficult for Western journalists to operate in Pakistan because they're often very visible, they're targets. So we, people all over the world, people like me, people like your listeners who care about what is happening in Pakistan, we're relying on journalists like Umar to keep us informed and to do their work. So I'm really inspired by him. I feel that he's making a sacrifice not only for the people of Pakistan, but for people all over the world who understand that news and information is crucial, and that the people who provide it are doing so in many circumstances at enormous risk.
And Umar, I'm curious about the thoughts that went through your head and why you decided to speak out about what was done to you.
The incident was a game changer in my life. As I was heading home, and before I was released, I was told more than once that in case you decide to speak up, if you go public to media, you will be picked up again with the consequences worse than before. Mm-hmm. So here mean, for me, the interpretation was worse mean that I'm being sent alive this time, the next time I may be killed. So the second warning was, the second threat was that in case I speak up, the pictures of my naked body that they took, they would be put on YouTube. They also made video of that during the course of torture. So they said that they that would also be put on YouTube. But I as I was headed home, I thought that what should I do? There were two options. There were two things that I could have done: either to speak silent, either to speak up. Either to stay silent, either to speak up. So silence could have been an option, but I did not choose it. It was not my choice. My choice was to speak up, because I thought that if I had to stay in journalism, I would be doing what I have been doing. In case I decide to remain silent, these people would continue blackmailing me for the whole life. And if I tell the people 6 months after, nobody would be believing my story. So I don't have to care for the consequences, what is going to happen, whether they pick me up again or not. But right now, I have to answer the question. The right now is that I have to speak up. Mm-hmm. So when I went back, I went straight to my editor. He was he was in shock that what happened to me. And you know that my shirt was already torn apart. So when I was headed home, I was covering the upper part of my body with the shawl that they had used for covering my head and face. So in that situation, my editor was in a very shocking condition. And in the meanwhile, we decided that no matter what happens, we have to speak up. What is happening again? And you know that this torture, it's not only about the physical torture. You feel psychologically tortured also. Thoughts kept haunting me all the time. I would wake up in the middle of night, realize, fearing, scaring, as somebody is beating at my back. And when I go outside, if somebody stares at me, I realize that he might be somebody belonging to the attackers. I was chased a number of times afterwards, but there was no let-up in determination. I realized the worst consequences of doing this. The worst consequence is that I may be killed. But I realized that if that happens, God forbid, if that happens again, I will be sacrificing my life fighting for a great cause. So this was a source of enormous satisfaction for me. It kept me strong and it kept me moving.
Well, Joel, let me get you back in on the conversation, and I'm listening, as we all are, listening to Umar Chima describe his determination to speak out, essentially willing to risk his life to, I guess, continue to tell stories and to write about Pakistan. But I know he's got a family as well, and, you know, this is a really difficult decision, it seems to me.
It's an incredibly difficult decision, and it's an incredibly brave decision, and it's a decision in which he's putting his own life on the line for something that he clearly believes in. And that's hard to imagine sometimes in this country where the right to speak out, to express ourselves, is really taken for granted. And journalists certainly reporting in the United States, there are circumstances where that involves some risks, but they're rare. And there's obviously an immense cynicism about journalism here in this country and the role that journalists play. But I think it's very important to think about these issues from a global perspective and what information means in a part of the world like Pakistan, where the government and violent forces within that society determine what people can and cannot know. So Umar is standing up for the right of people in Pakistan to be informed, to hold their government to account. But he's standing up, as I said, for all of us, for people all over the world who care about what's happening in their country, who want information, because it is Umar and people like Umar who are fulfilling that role for all of us.
And Umar, I can only, or I actually can't understand the kinds of risks that you are taking to speak out, but I'm also wondering whether speaking out has also protected you, because now people in Pakistan know what happened to you, and people in the United States are learning about what has happened to you as well. Do you see that as a bit of an insurance policy?
Yeah, it helps. Speaking out helps. I didn't realize it when I did. I didn't have the idea that how it is going to help, because then I was completely, soon after the torture, I was quite scared.
Sure.
Then doing so, speaking up, means that I'm taking the biggest risk in my life, that I'm doing that what I have been asked not to do. So what is going to happen, I don't know, but later I realized that it has helped protecting me also. Although it was risky, but it was also protective.
Well, I read that the Prime Minister called you.
Yeah, he did. He did. Soon after the news was put on air, the same day he rang me and he said that we are going to set up investigation committees for probing that who has done it. It's another story that nothing has been done. Those committees were set up, but the investigation hasn't reached to any conclusive end.
And that's Umar Chima. He's an investigative reporter with the Pakistani daily newspaper called The News, and he has been reporting on politics and national security, terrorism, and corruption. He was abducted in September 2010 by some unknown assailants at this point. They were wearing police uniforms. He was stripped and beaten and photographed in humiliating positions, and he is being honored tomorrow night by the Committee to Protect Journalists, and Joel Simon, the executive director of CBJ, also joining us today on Radio Times to talk about Umar Chima and other journalists around the world who are frankly risking their lives to report on the news. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Joel, going back to you and the fact that your organization, the Committee to Protect Journalists, has an impunity, graph, that the numbers of journalists who have been either killed or terrorized, that very few people have ever been found guilty of this behavior.
Right, and this is a problem in so many parts of the world. And in fact, we were in Pakistan in May. Coincidentally, we had a CPJ delegation there when the raid took place that killed Osama bin Laden. But the next day, we had a chance to meet with Pakistani President Zardari, and we presented him with a list of 15 Pakistani journalists who've been murdered. And in all of these cases, there have been no investigation. This is 15 journalists who've been killed since Daniel Pearl. Now, everyone knows about Daniel mm-hmm. Pearl. He was a reporter for the Wall Street Journal. He was kidnapped and executed. But what few people realize is, and there was an investigation into his case, a couple of people have been convicted in that crime, but there have been 15, and now even more than that, at the time we met with the president, there were 15 incidents in which Pakistani journalists were killed, some under similar circumstances, and there have been no investigations. So we presented this to the president. He made some commitments to us, and this is the kind of thing we do as part of the impunity campaign. Unfortunately, we have not seen follow-up from the government of Pakistan. To the contrary, there's actually been an increase in violence, but we'll continue to hold them to account, to highlight their deficiencies, to highlight their failure to fulfill their obligation to investigate these crimes and bring those responsible to justice. And we're doing that on a global level.
And quoting from your Getting Away with Murder article, Russia and Mexico, two of the world's most murderous countries for the press, are heading in different directions in combating deadly anti-press violence. Two different directions, how?
Well, it's very interesting. And we've been very active in Russia and in Mexico, and we've had a number of meetings with Russian authorities, and we pressured them to carry out investigations into the killings that have taken place there. And in fact, there was a conviction in a prominent murder case. There have been some arrests. And what's interesting also is that the level of violence against Russian journalists seems to have declined. We have not seen a killing of a journalist in Russia in 2 years. Now, that does not mean that Russia is a press freedom paradise. Far from it. There are huge obstacles and impediments to the exercise of independent journalism there. But we're certainly heartened by the fact that the level of violence has decreased. In Mexico, it's moving in the other direction. In Mexico, we've had also meetings with the president. We presented our demands to the president. We've gotten commitments from the president of Mexico. Unfortunately, they have not been carried out, and the level of violence is continuing to increase. The most of the violence is perpetrated by the drug cartels, many of which operate with some level of government protection, and they're not only going after professional journalists, they're going after bloggers and citizen journalists and anyone who criticizes them or challenges their authority, and the government appears helpless to provide even a modicum of security that would make the kind of daily reporting, the day-to-day meat and potatoes kind of reporting that people expect in any community to take place. That is not happening in large areas of Mexico.
When you say helpless, do you mean incapable of or unwilling to?
Well, I think it's a combination. I mean, I think that in some cases they're incapable of, and in other cases they're unwilling. The structure, and this is true in Pakistan, it's true in Russia, it's true in many parts of the world, the structures that permit criminals to operate are usually some level of government protection. So it could be protection at the state level, at the local level. Somebody needs to be turning a blind eye to their activities. And in some parts of the country, the drug cartels are so powerful and the protection they have is so deep, in other words, they've corrupted the government at such a high level that the federal government and federal authorities are actually incapable of providing any sort of protection. And in other cases, I think they're just indifferent. to this issue. They're confronted with massive levels of violence throughout the country at all sectors of society, and they frankly feel overwhelmed.
Umar Jimmy, let me go back to you, and I'm also curious because I understand that you have a family, and the idea of speaking out obviously is a risk you're willing to take, and I'm just curious about the kind of conversations you might have had with your family about your willingness to do so.
You know, the time I was picked up, the most horrifying thought in my mind was about my son.
Sure.
That in case I'm killed, I had done, and then one son. I have a daughter now too. So then I had a son. So I was thinking about him, that what is going to happen with him in case I'm killed, because he is too small, and who will feed him properly, and who will take care of his education. So these were the thoughts in my mind, but you know, that were quite depressing thought, and at the moment, I had to remain strong. So I told myself, Umar, you are not here by choice. Kidnapping means that you have been forced here. You have been forced being here. So I thought that I should just keep my attention on the point that what they are going to do with me in case I am dead. My feelings about my family, my feeling about my son, they will also be dead. So I have to be here first to get the answer of this question, that what is going to happen.
Mm.
Later, after the incident and the decision of speaking up, I remain worried, and these are the questions that remain alive. I don't have the answer. But, you know, sometimes you have to be different from others, and sometimes your concerns have to be different from common concerns. That is a concern of everybody. Everybody has to be careful, has to take care of his family. But right now, the situation was entirely different. The circumstances were extraordinary, and it was expecting mm-hmm. extraordinary answers from me.
Does your son, he's your older child, does he know the kind of risks his dad is taking?
He is 3 and a half now. So he is not quite aware, although he saw the footage after the incident. He saw me in a bad shape, and he was quite horrific, and sometimes he would asking me questions that, Dad, what happened? What happened to your head? Because my head was shaved, and my eyebrows were shaved, and I didn't have the answer, and I don't want to feed hatred into his mind. I want to stay neutral, and I want to grow up him in a better way so that he could also spend time fighting for some noble reason.
Well, let's take another short break, and we'll get back to our conversation. That's Umar Chima. He is an investigative reporter for The News, and that's Pakistan's daily newspaper. He's been covering corruption and politics, terrorism, and national security. And about a year ago, September 2011, he was kidnapped, beaten, humiliated, told to keep quiet. Instead, he has gone public with what happened to him, and he's being honored tomorrow night at the 2011 International Press Freedom Award. And this is a ceremony from the Committee to Protect Journalists honoring 4 intrepid journalists. And Umar Chima, obviously one of our guests today on Radio Times. And the other guest, Joel Simon, Executive Director of the Committee to Protect Journalists. We're going to take a very short break, then get back to our conversation. Any questions or comments? Lines open, 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. This Thanksgiving weekend, Christoph Eschenbach returns to lead the Philadelphia Orchestra in 2 Beethoven symphonies, numbers 4 and 8, and Jennifer Coe plays Brooks' first violin concerto. For your tickets, 215-893-1999 or at philorc.org. This Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, Thanksgiving weekend at the Kimmel Center, Eschenbach conducts Beethoven with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
David Coleman Headley was one of the leaders of the terrorist attack on Mumbai. The son of a Pakistani father and American mother, Headley became a drug smuggler, then a DEA informant, and after 9/11, an Islamic militant while working for the DEA. On the next Fresh Air, we speak with investigative reporter Sebastian Rotella about his new Frontline documentary. Join us.
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY. Holiday gatherings punctuate our year. They mark the change of seasons, but also personal changes and rites of passage in our lives. Sometimes there's word of a new job, a new baby, an illness, a separation, a death. On the next Voices in the Family with Dan Gottlieb, who's coming to dinner? How families mark the passage of time with pronouncements, births, feuds, and feasts over the holidays. Today at noon, here on WHYY-FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain. We're talking about journalists who have taken great risks to tell important stories, have endured things like threats and harassment, assault, censorship, and torture. Umar Chima, one of those reporters, also with us, Joel Simon, executive director of the Committee to Protect Journalists. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Joel, picking up on something that you had said earlier about the journalists around the world who are risking their lives to tell these stories, that bloggers have been called out and essentially identified. Are there parts of the world that are more dangerous than other parts of the world to report from?
Oh, well, absolutely. I mean, I think you can sort of put the risk into two broad categories. There's the risk of violence, the kind of thing we've been talking about with Umar, where either criminal organizations or militant groups or the government itself is using violent tactics to censor certain kinds of information. And then there's official state repression or, you know, censorship, which you find in places like China or Vietnam or Burma or Cuba, those are places where violent repression against journalists is less common, but there's systematic state repression and state censorship, and so and the risk is that you will be picked up and jailed. All those countries are places where journalists are routinely jailed. And in some places, unfortunately, you have both. Mm. You have the risk of violence, and you have the risk of going to jail. So you have both a kind of anarchic environment in which you might say this is a situation in Egypt today. There's a lot going on in Egypt today, as we know. There are renewed demonstrations in Tahrir Square, and journalists have been injured covering those demonstrations. Meanwhile, the military government has become increasingly repressive. A blogger is in jail. There are threats of arrest against other bloggers. So that's a place where journalists face both the risk of physical attack and the risk of state repression.
Umar, if I can go back to you, and I know that you have, I'm not sure if organized is quite the right word, but I know that other journalists in Pakistan have, in a sense, rallied around your cause to speak out. Can you talk a bit about that?
You know, the scene of speaking has inspired the confidence of many journalists, and they feel strong, and they realize that, yes, it pays a lot, and it helps the cause. You know that I had received numerous offers of settling abroad, very exciting offers, but I decided otherwise. I decided to remain in Pakistan. The reason, I realized that there are many journalists who are getting inspired. In case I leave the country, they will be feeling betrayed. And second, unless you are in your country, you cannot contest the established narrative. You cannot contest the repressive narrative. So I realized that there are more people. Now they are gathering courage, and everybody realized that nobody has to speak up, nobody has to remain silent, because before me, a number of cases occurred that where the journalists decided that speaking up would bring them more trouble, and they decided not to. But after my case, there are journalists that if something happens to them, they become more vocal, they come up with what happened with them, things like that.
I was reading that when you were kidnapped and being beaten, you were told, and I'm quoting, your reporting has upset the government. When the word the government is used, what does that mean in Pakistan?
Absolutely. They said that your reporting has brought this trouble for you. The government, they made it sure, the attackers made it sure that they belong to the government.
But at the same time, they did their best to hide their identity, that nobody, I could not recognize that which department of the government they belong. But my investigation later on, the way they operation and they handled the operation and my investigation later on, it concluded that they belong to the intelligence agencies of the government. Mm.
The ISI.
I'm not sure. ISI is denying it. But I said that I had my certain doubts that it has been done by them. But they are saying that we haven't done it. So far we haven't got any other evidence that somebody else is involved. Because you know that the agency's operation, they are so discreet. And they are done in a, such a prudent manner that they don't leave any tangible evidence behind that that could be produced in a court of law to prove that who did it.
You are an investigative journalist. Have you been investigating then what happened to you and reporting on it?
No, I haven't. You mean that had I investigated my own case or not?
Exactly.
No, first of all, it should have been done by somebody else. Mm-hmm. But obviously, after my case, there no matter the journalist felt inspired, but obviously there was, it also created a panic. Everybody was in a panic condition for some time. And second, since there were two investigative bodies were set up, one was Judicial Commission and the other was Criminal Investigation Body. Judicial Commission had to just give a direction that who should be investigated, things like that. It deposited its report to the government, but it has never been made public. It has never been shared with me even. Mm-hmm. Second was the Criminal Investigation Body. It has done nothing. Their performance is very dissatisfactory, and they could not move beyond what they found out in the first meeting, and what they found out it was quite ridiculous. And they didn't want to get to the right person. The reason they realized that if there is no will, strong will at the top level to investigate the case, why should they take risk?
Mm. Joel, if I can go back to you, and I was also reading that the body of a missing Pakistani journalist was discovered earlier this month, about 180 miles or so from the city of Quetta. And I know, Umar, you know this journalist, but Joel, I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about who this is.
Well, to be honest, that probably would be better for Umar to talk about it.
You're talking about Salim Shahzad?
I'm not sure if you're talking about Salim. So Salim Shahzad was a journalist who was actually killed in May, and he was a very prominent journalist who reported on some of the alleged ties between al-Qaeda and the Pakistani military. As you can imagine, that was a very sensitive story. And he was picked up also in Islamabad, and in some ways the operation, although we obviously don't know the details since he did not survive, but appear to be reminiscent of what happened with Umar, except sadly he was beaten to death with iron rods. And I can only imagine, you know, the impact that had on Umar, because the people who abducted him said next time it would be even worse. I think what happened to Salim Shahzad might be what they meant.
Umar, do you want to weigh in on that?
You know, it was quite horrible. And, you know, when I heard the news about his killing, I realized that I am the intended recipient of this news, because I felt as the message is that you were sent alive and now look what happened to the person who has been picked up after you. It was quite horrific, and you know that luck becomes relative term in such circumstances. It was only then when I realized that I was lucky to be sent home alive, and my friend has lost his life. There is no plausible development on his case, yes, but it has made journalists more vocal. It has put the intelligence agencies on defensive. The journalists, they no more remain silent. They become vocal, they become critical towards the role of the security agencies. And it was due to the journalists. They stayed a sit-in for a whole night in front of the parliament, demanding for the setting up of a judicial commission. And it was finally done by the Supreme Court of Pakistan, not by the government. So the judicial commission, it is in the process of investigation. It has recorded statement from the family, from the journalists who were in the know of the threats he was receiving, and the other people who could contribute in any way in helping the investigation of the murder. But you know that the judicial commission has its constraint. It cannot fix responsibility. It just it can analyze the statements that it collects from different sources. Those who were the friends or who are who can help in getting to the killers, and the other who are being accused. So their statements are analyzed, and then it can just give a conclusion that we should put the investigation on these lines, and then come the responsibility of the government agencies, the police department and the others, that they should investigate the people, they should investigate the departments. But at this point, the investigation is going to stop.
Omar, the fact that it looks like journalists are being targeted in Pakistan, can we assume that activists and those critical of the government, or maybe even some of these organized groups, are also being targeted?
Yeah, they are being targeted. And you know that actually the situation has become alarming after 9/11. The reason? Because sometimes they don't know who is going to kill them. For example, if there is a war on terror going on, if there is some operation, military operation, the journalists are maybe a victim of militants, they may be a victim of military. There is some insurgency, moderate insurgency going on in Balochistan. So sometimes they become, they are killed either by the insurgents or by the security forces. In Karachi, there are some ethno-political organizations. They have raised their militant wings. So if some journalists speak against them, they are target killed. And the fourth category of the killing of journalists, that is due to the lack of training. Sometimes when they cover the conflict, they don't know how to do it. So they become part of an actor of conflict. When they get into the conflict and they are killed in cross-firing, or there is some blast occurred and they are killed. So there, it has different dimensions and the vulnerability they are facing today.
Joel, let me go back to you and actually looking something that you wrote for CNN back in September. The headline is "How War on Terror Unleashed a War on Journalists." And Omar was describing how things are more unsettled in his country of Pakistan since September 11th. Can you expand on that a bit?
Yeah, this was an opportunity, the 10-year anniversary of 9/11, to look back on the impact around the world. And what I was arguing is that the rhetoric that the Bush administration employed at the time, and particularly some of the heated debates we had domestically about the role of the media and, you know, not the time to criticize your government, etc. Well, some of that has died down domestically, but globally there's been a long-term impact. And in so many countries around the world, critical journalism is equated with terrorism. Journalists are called terrorism. Journalists who write critical stories are accused of supporting terrorists. This is true in Pakistan, but it's also true in places like Ethiopia, where journalists are in jail on terrorism charges. It's true in even in Mexico, where the drug traffickers have been rebranded as narco-terrorists. They engage in certainly some of their tactics or terrorist tactics, but that's a pretty sweeping net to try and, you know, catch everybody in. So around the world, 10 years on, we're seeing governments still employing this language. And what's bearing this out is the fact that the number of journalists in jail around the world, it was around 80 in the year 2000. It jumped to about 120 the next year, 2001, at the end of that year, when governments engaged in a sort of wave of repressive action. And it stayed high. In fact, it's continued to climb. So there's been a long-lasting legacy. Journalism in many parts of the world is equated with terrorism. Critical journalism is considered a terroristic activity, and that's having a broad impact on press freedom conditions all over the globe.
But quoting from your article, you also criticize President Obama's, and I'm quoting, your record as a zealous classifier of government documents, has institutionalized increased official secrecy, legal efforts to compel journalists to reveal confidential sources are prevalent, and you go on from there. I mean, as you said, you began by criticizing the Bush administration, but it sounds like you also have some criticism for President Obama.
Well, absolutely. And what I'm, the point I'm trying to make is that, you know, these domestic debates are important because they affect our ability in this country to have access to information, the ability of the press to function. But the point I was also trying to make is they have a ripple effect around the world. Governments all over the world, repressive governments, are looking for justification for cover for their repressive policies, and whatever slippage takes place in the United States becomes a very convenient justification for their own actions. So we have a responsibility to our own people in this country in terms of these kinds of policies, but we also have a responsibility to set a standard globally, and any slippage here reverberates around the world, and that's the point I was trying to make.
And we're almost out of time here. Have you talked to the Obama administration about your concerns?
Oh, we talk to them all the time, and you know, we let them know, you know, about, we make this argument to them on a regular basis. And I should also say that, you know, we make arguments to them about policies in specific places like Pakistan or like Mexico, or like Bahrain and Belarus, the places where our awardees come. So this is an ongoing dialogue. I will say that we do have the opportunity to make these arguments on a regular basis with the Obama administration, and in many cases they have been responsive.
Well, Joel Simon, as always, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. He's Executive Director of the Committee to Protect Journalists. And Umar Chima, thank you so much for joining us on Radio Times. Congratulations on your award, and please do stay safe.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And he's an investigative reporter for The News. That's Pakistan's daily newspaper. And he's one of four journalists being honored tonight by the Committee to Protect Journalists. And this is the 2011 International Press Freedom Awards. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. Al Banks and, Bob Halls and Kevin Griffin, the engineers for today's edition of Radio Times. It's produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty Leswing, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.